John chapter 6 and verse 1 says, sometime after this, Jesus crossed to the far shore of the Sea of Galilee. That is the Sea of Tiberias. And a great crowd of people followed him because they saw the signs he had performed by healing the sick. Then Jesus went up a mountainside and sat down with his disciples. The Jewish Passover festival was near. When Jesus looked up and saw a great crowd coming toward him, he said to Philip, "Where shall we buy bread for these people to eat?" He asked him this only to test him, for he already had in mind what he was going to do. Philip answered him, "It would take more than half a year's wages to buy enough bread for each one to have a bite." Another of his disciples, Andrew, Simon Peter's brother, spoke up. "Here is a boy with five small barley loaves and two small fish. But how will they go? How far will they go among so many?" Jesus said, "Have the people sit down." There was plenty of grass in that place, and they sat down. About 5,000 men were there. Jesus then took the loaves, gave thanks, and distributed to those who were seated as much as they wanted. He did the same with the fish. When they'd had all enough to eat, he said to his disciples, "Gather the pieces that are left over. Let nothing be wasted." So they gathered them and filled 12 baskets with the pieces of 5 barley loaves left over by those who had eaten. After the people saw the sign Jesus performed, they began to say, "Surely this is the prophet who's come into the world." Jesus, knowing that they intended to come and make him king by force, withdrew again to a mountain by himself. It's one of the most famous miracles Jesus does. The feeding of the 5,000. It's recorded in all of the Gospels. Matthew 14, Matthew makes it clear it's 5,000 men, not including women and children. So there's a lot of people. And it's clear from all of the gospel accounts there's a discussion about feeding these people. But John 6 has a very particular discussion. Jesus initiates a conversation with Philip in John 6 and verse 5 and says, "Where are we going to buy bread to feed these people?" The following verse tells us he already knows what he's going to do. So he's not asking Philip for a meaningful suggestion. He is fully God. He's got a plan. And there's the ability to read this story in some of the gospel accounts and think that it was the disciples' initiative that brought the 5 loaves and 2 fish to him. It wasn't. Mark 6 and verse 38, Jesus sends them to go and get food from among the crowd. He has a clear idea of what he's going to do in the situation. So he doesn't expect Philip to give him a meaningful suggestion. And I'm going to suggest to you that he doesn't actually expect Philip to know what's going to happen. See, Jesus doesn't ask the question, "How will we provide for these people?" He doesn't say, "How will we feed them?" The question's really, really specific. Where will we buy bread for these people? Jesus has no intention of buying bread. He's got no intention of buying bread. Yet he asks the question, "Where will we buy bread for these people?" It would be unfair to expect Philip to say, "Well, obviously, Lord, we're not going to buy bread. You're going to take this child's lunch and turn it into food for everybody." That's not a reasonable response to the question, "Where will we buy this bread?" And I make that point for this reason. I think very often we talk about a faith response to some things, and what we're really talking about is us second-guessing the mind of God. I think he's crystal clear. His ways are not our ways. His thoughts are not our thoughts. As high as the heavens are above the earth, so high are his ways to our ways and his thoughts to ours. Jesus is not asking Philip the question, where will we buy bread? So Philip can in faith declare, Lord, you're going to miraculously supply this from a child's lunch. He's led him to a specific thought. It is to purchase bread. So he's not trying to pull the answer of the situation out of Philip. And I think the answer's really clear. Where will we buy bread for these people? Verse 3 tells us they're on a mountainside. In Mark 6 and verse 32, setting the scene for this situation, it says they went away by themselves in a boat to a solitary place. But many who saw them leaving recognized them and ran on foot from all towns and got there ahead of them. When Jesus landed and saw a large crowd, he had compassion on them because they were like sheep without a shepherd. So he began teaching them many things. By this time, it was late in the day, so his disciples came to him and said, "This is a remote place, and it's already very late. Send the people away so that they can go to the surrounding countryside and village and buy themselves something to eat." Where will we buy these people bread? Here's the straight answer. There's nowhere to buy them bread. We're on a mountain, Jesus. We're in a solitary place. It's late in the day. There's nowhere to buy bread for these people. Me. The boy who brought food with him has got 5 loaves and 2 fish. Let's assume 5 loaves is sufficient food for everybody in terms of an individual meal for each person. That's 25,000 loaves for the 5,000 men. If there's one woman and one child with every man, you're at 75,000 loaves. Some people estimate there was 25,000 people there. That's 125,000 loaves. It's a lot of bread. It's a lot of bread for us. Now, with our factories and our supermarkets, with electricity and ovens, with kitchen aids and all sorts of other appliances, it's a lot of bread. There is no electricity. There's no factory. Generally, you make your own bread. So the answer to the question is we don't buy bread. There is nowhere to buy bread. Philip doesn't get consumed with where, but how? That's Philip's issue, right? 200 denarii, half a year's wages, isn't enough to buy bread for these people. We don't have the means to buy the bread if the bread was available. I'm going to assume to feed 15,000 people, you're going to have visited a lot of first century bakeries. And I'm not an expert on bakeries. But the one thing I do understand is that later in the day, the less stuff they have because they tend to bake in the morning. So this is the straightforward situation, right? Jesus says, where can we buy bread for these people? And it's apparently a test. And we really struggle with that, I think. Because our desire is to be right. We read the words, it's a test, and our desire is to pass. So, Jesus asked a question, where will we buy bread? I'm suggesting the answer is, you won't. Philip's answer is we don't have the means to afford bread for all of these people. The reality is, there isn't a solution. There isn't a solution. I'm telling you, they're in a mountainside in a solitary place. Where will they buy bread? I don't think it's not like, shall we go to Asda or Sainsbury's or Tesco's today, Philip? That's not the question, right? We're in a place where there isn't the facility to buy bread. But even if there was the facility, Philip's drawing our attention to the fact there isn't the finance to afford it. So the sum of the situation is there is no solution here. So how do I respond? What do I do when there is no way forward? What is it that I do in response to a situation that's impossible? Because I'm going to suggest to you, Jesus deliberately asks a question that has no relevance to his intention to do what he's going to do. Right? Jesus isn't planning on buying bread. John's crystal clear. He already knew what he was going to do. But he asked the question, where are we going to buy bread? So the only purpose of the question is to draw attention to the fact this is an impossible situation. He's not trying to lead Philip astray. He's not setting him up for failure. Where do we buy bread for all of these people? Well, we can't. We can't afford the bread. We don't know what to do. I talked to you last week about the need to recognize your need of him. Or at least I tried to. But I made this statement in talking to you about it. That I believe there were times where God drew your attention to the fact that there was no other option in order to demonstrate your need of him. That's what I'm telling you is happening in John 6 here. There's a situation that doesn't have a clear resolution. And let me make this observation. Philip is consumed with how. If we had half a year's wages, it would only be enough for them each to have a bite. I feel like I'm like Philip in that. Because everything God does and everything he says he intends to do, I want to understand how. How? What's fascinating to me about the 5 loaves and 2 fishes story is whilst I'm crystal clear about what happens beforehand, and crystal clear what happens afterwards, the bit that I'm really, really interested in is that middle bit. And I've no idea. Jesus broke bread, gave thanks, and they started distributing it. And I know they picked up 12 baskets of the 5 loaves. I mean, that sentence doesn't make any sense in and of itself, right? I understand that at the end of it, this happened. And I know beforehand there was a whole conversation about what will we do. But that middle bit, where the miraculous actually happens, seems to just drift on through the story. All of the gospel accounts, none of them bother to record the exact detail of what happened in those moments. Why? I don't think I'm meant to understand how. I don't think I'm meant to understand how. I don't think I'm able to answer that question all of the time. I don't think I'm meant to be able to explain the detail of what God does in the miraculous. If God intends to do something, I don't think I'm always going to be explaining to you how that happens. And it's clearly miraculous. But I'm going to suggest to you that in spite of most of the commentaries I've read, I don't think the test that Philip has is as straightforward as have you passed or failed? It's easy to bash Philip knowing the story. Why did he not have more faith? He was at the wedding in Cana. He's seen Jesus perform miracle after miracle. But Jesus asks him a question. This wasn't Philip coming and expressing his doubt. Jesus asks him the question. Where shall we buy bread? Jesus does it, I'm suggesting you, to draw his attention to the impossibility of the situation. And I don't believe Jesus wanted Philip to say, somebody brought lunch, it's okay, we'll be fine, Jesus. He wants him to acknowledge, this is impossible. This is impossible. I don't know. And perhaps that is something that, as Christians at times, we are not wholly comfortable with. I don't know. I know the one who knows, but I don't know. I am in relationship with God who sees everything, who knows the end from the beginning, who before a situation, before he's even confronted with a situation, has a plan about how to resolve it. But the reality is, I don't know. How do we feed all of these people? I don't know. What do you do? I don't know. Is that a lack of faith? No. Because rather than, excuse my phrasing of this, but waffling some nonsense, which is what we have a tendency to do sometimes, right? Rather than just be honest about the fact we don't know how God's going to do what he's going to do, we try and find a way to make sense of what God's doing in a specific situation and logically conclude how he's going to work that out and then tell other people that's what he's doing and call it faith. It's not faith because you understand it. Forgive me. I'll try not to rant. But that's it's where we sit sometimes, right? In this position of where if we just profess something, then it must. I believe that my starting point is the acknowledgement, I don't know. I believe that great faith lives in the place where you don't know, but you believe anyway. Where you can't see a way forward, but you trust him anyway. Where it doesn't make sense. Where there isn't an obvious solution, but I can believe God for it anyway. Romans 4, verse 19. It's one of my favorite bits of the Bible. It says, without weakening in his faith, Abraham faced the fact that his body was good as dead, since he was about 100 years old, and that Sarah's womb was also dead. Yet he did not waver through unbelief regarding the promise of God, but was strengthened in his faith and gave glory to God, being fully persuaded that God had the power to do what he promised. Verse 18 says, against all hope, in hope, Abraham believed, and it was credit to him as righteousness. He looked at the situation and denied nothing of the facts of it. He's 100. His body's as good as dead. Sarah's womb has never produced life. And now at this stage of life, it's very much less likely to than at any point before. There's nothing about the situation that works. It makes no sense. You're going to have a son. I think at 100 I'd say, no thank you, but and the reality of his circumstances can't be denied. The impossibility of the situation can't be denied. But it doesn't undermine his faith. So Jesus highlights the reality of an impossible situation to one of his disciples. Does it undermine your faith? Because I think the tendency at times is for us to deny the reality of our circumstances in order that we might hold on to hope. To pretend they don't exist at times, at least. Because we can't fathom how this works. And so in order to at least believe that this might happen, I have to choose. Either I live in reality or I live in my Christian bubble. It's sort of how it's played out sometimes, right? Because everything doesn't make sense. I think that's the point of the miraculous. I think that's the point of having a relationship with God. I think actually the reality is I'm meant to live in a place where I acknowledge, I don't know. I don't know. That there are big question marks over how the promises of God get fulfilled in my life. That there are question marks over how he works all things together for good. That there are question marks over how he finishes the thing he began in me. That I look on the edge of a Red Sea and wonder, what do we do now? But where you turn your attention to in those moments matters. See, I don't think the test was, Philip, can you predict what I'm going to do? It wasn't one of those guess what happens next videos. It wasn't, Philip, will you engage with the conversation I'm having, or will you just bounce back? Oh, Lord, you'll do something. Yeah. I'm suggesting to you the test was, Philip, this is impossible. How do you feel about that? How's that going to sit with you? And I might be wrong. But I think it's a question worth answering for our own lives. What do you do when you don't know? How do you respond when it's impossible? And we've been giving some thought to transformation, or at least I've been trying to. That we would behold his glory, be transformed from glory to glory, not conformed to the pattern of this world, but be transformed by the renewing of our mind. Let me suggest one of the biggest challenges, I think, in the renewing of your mind is that you might end up with less answers after than before. Because the thing that we do so quickly is try to rush to a solution in our own thinking. It's to find a way that we can see this through. It's to find a solution in and of ourselves that resolves something. And actually what I might be needing to do is go, God, I don't know, but you do. And this might be a hopeless situation from all angles, but I still believe you're able. God, this might be lost as far as everybody else is concerned, but I am confident that you fulfill your promises, that you keep your word and you do all that you said you would. And I can't explain how, and I can't justify why, and I won't be able to tell everybody else what you're going to do and how that's going to look so it makes sense to them, but I believe you anyway. Not the most comfortable place to live. But I'm going to suggest to you it is the faith-filled response. Should we stand together and worship?